The Daily Connect Podcast.
Hello, I'm Stephen Scott, and this is the Daily Connect podcast for Monday, the 17th of September, 2018. Coming up, we are going to be meeting Jeanette Scott. She is an RNIB Connect volunteer, and she's going to tell us all about the wonderful stuff that she does at RNIB and how she helps other blind and partially sighted people like her. Also, we're going to meet Armila, who, after losing her sight, decided she wanted to go on a cruise ship once again, but this journey was going to be very different to the previous cruises that she'd had. And we meet Sue Taylor, who tells us about her guide dog Leo and gets into some very honest territory when she talks about the relationship between her and her guide dog, because she talks about how it impacts on her relationship with her husband. That's coming up. But first, we are going to talk about a very important campaign, and that is accessible voting, something that RNIB has been fighting for some time. But, well, finally at last, it seems government is listening. We hear now from Chloe Smith MP, who's the MP for Constitution, and she talks to us about the ongoing campaign to find out more about what blind and partially sighted people think about accessible voting so that government can decide how to make changes going forward.
We launched a call for evidence because we knew that there were some real challenges there. And what we wanted to find out was more of that personal direct experience from disabled people, including those with sight loss, and their experience in terms of both registering to vote and then casting the vote itself. We really wanted to find out examples of good practice or indeed bad practice from around the country, because then that's the kind of thing we can help share or help investigate. And we wanted in particular to give people a voice. And I'm really pleased to say that the call for evidence was certainly successful in that sense. We had lots of people come forward, also lots of organisations, including RNIB. And it showed us a lot. So the outcome is that we've published a series of actions that we're going to get going on, again, working with the RNIB and many others. I would also note that the call for evidence spanned, of course, people with various types of disabilities. So in particular, we were trying to group those up in ways that we could make actions respond to people's needs. So, for example, we've got things in here that I think would be important to those with sight loss, but also things here that are important to those who suffer from mental ill health, those with a learning disability, and also those with mobility problems. So we're very conscious that, of course, there's a great amount of difference under those different pieces of evidence that were given. This call for evidence really spanned across the whole process of getting registered to vote, to then getting your information, to casting your vote. So you're absolutely right to make sure we focus on that. One of the actions we're going to be taking here, actually, is to look at the viability of sending such information out in different ways, including by electronic means. There are a couple of councils who've done this already. It could potentially be done on request by people who know that it would be helpful to them. The key thing there is to assess its usefulness and, crucially, to identify any security issues so that, of course, everybody's vote is safe.
So that's all great, but what about electronic voting?
It's something I'm very interested in as a discussion, and again, would be very happy to hear from any listeners today who have strong feelings on this. I'm aware that it's something that people might feel is, you know, its time is coming in the century in which we live. The crucial thing I do think is to make sure that its security considerations are properly looked at. I think it's very important, actually, that we make sure that we continue to protect our democracy. It mustn't be run in a way that either lets individuals down by their individual vote being possible to be damaged or, as it were, stolen in some way. But also, of course, it mustn't let the whole of our democracy down. You know, we must make sure at both of those levels that our democracy is secure. So it's a complex topic, the idea of voting electronically, but I'd be very interested in people's experiences who might be listening to this today.
Well, don't just sit there and complain about it at home. Get involved and join the conversation at radio@rnib.org.uk.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Let's now meet another of RNIB's committed band of volunteers. Jeanette Scott talked to our own Barry Snell here at RNIB Connect Radio about the kind of things that she's doing in her local area, but things she wants to do more of in her native town of Stirling.
Currently with RNIB, I'm wearing a couple of caps. I'm one of the Connect leads for the West of Scotland for RNIB. It's a new services that have been set up to promote and encourage blind people of all abilities and disabilities and age groups to get out and about and to try new things for themselves. For example, they've set up a new tandem cycling group in Glasgow, and it's to encourage people to get out on a bike, even if they've not been on one before. That's one of the new groups that's been set up. Also, there's been some local walking groups and some other groups been set up, for example, knitting, and whatever people need, we're here to help assist them to do things that they want to do rather than what we want them to do.
So have you had a good feedback from the visually impaired community? Are you getting good numbers attending?
Yes, I think the cycling seems to be taking off quite well. The only problem I have with it is it's quite a long journey for me to go from Stirling through in the trains on a Saturday to Glasgow and then get my way through to Glasgow Green with a guide dog. I haven't got the facility at home to leave her by herself for that long a time. So I would actually prefer a group being set up nearer to me in Stirling. And that's what I'm working on at the moment as well, to try and encourage people in the Stirling area to get out on bikes and things and try to set up a new group. There's another group that's just been set up in Edinburgh, I believe, as well, through another organisation.
You're actually working as the lead connector for the West of Scotland at the moment,
there's
anyway.
There's a few of us that are volunteers for West of Scotland Leeds with the Connect team, and it's actually proving to be very popular. And we've had quite a few people joining recently.
And on top of that, I believe you were involved in setting up a talking book group with RNIB's Jamila Sheikh.
She's lovely. She wanted people who are vision impaired to try and meet together and discuss books. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did on Saturday. There was 4 vision impaired people came with guide dogs, and we all sat round and discussed a book that we had just read. And it proved to be very interesting and exciting. And of course, the discussion went off topic a few times, but we all got on very well together. And
that excellent.
We're trying to encourage more members to join. And obviously, we're looking for books to read as well.
You're doing some fundraising as well, aren't you, for a specific book?
Yes, I'm fundraising in Stirling specifically for the Community Talking Books. So far, since the end of last year, we've raised enough money for a children's talking book. Angela from RNIB is assisting with that. So she helped me set up a page on Just Giving to promote Stirling Community Talking Books. And also, I've got a lot of help in Stirling from John Riley, who works for Stirling Council. He's been a great help. He's visually impaired, but also is a worker at Stirling Council. And he has a great team of people who helped with a disco recently and also a bake sale. And I think there's some more venues coming up in the future to raise more money in Stirling for Community Talking Books.
Lots going on. If anyone would like to contribute, how could they do so?
You can do it through RNIB, through Just Giving. If you look up on the Just Giving site, there's RNIB, and it'll be under Community Talking Books for Stirling specifically.
Sounds good. Thank you for giving us your time, Jeanette, and thank you for setting up all these groups and working with others as well. That's what this is all about here at RNIB Connect. The clue's in the name.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Now time for pause for thought, a chance for us to find out about those all-important relationships between guide dog owners and their furry companions. We're going to meet Sue Taylor today, who talked to us on the show all about her guide dog, Leo. Now Sue's from Wiltshire, but she talks about not just the relationship between her and Leo, but how the guide dog has impacted on her relationship with her husband.
Many years ago, I was quite housebound for approximately 10 years. I would make more and more excuses not to go out. And my social worker at the time made the suggestion that perhaps I should contact guide dogs. My husband and I were obviously looking to the future as well, because if ever anything happened to my husband, I needed to be independent. And at that point in time, I was on a very low edge, and I needed my confidence building, and I needed to get out of the house. So I contacted guide dogs, and they assessed my needs, and that's where my journey started. The first day Leo walked into my life, he changed it totally. To have Leo on a harness taking me out of the hotel in training actually put a smile on my face. I feel that it's a privilege to have Leo, and I'm proud to be part of Guide Dogs. Leo is worth his weight in gold, because Leo gets me out of the front door. He makes me smile, but one of the things you have to think about when you have a guide dog is it can affect your relationship with your partner or your husband. they have to get used to the changes because they are no longer your carer stroke husband. They have to take a little bit of a step backwards. And when we first get home with our guide dog, it's a different world. My husband and I always used to walk out holding hands, and that's something we can't do now, because if I hold my husband's hand, then Leo will look at me and think, she doesn't need me anymore, so he will back off. So when we go out, I can't hold my husband's hand, but that's only a little bit of a change. I think the way I've changed has been for the better, and Leo and guide dogs have made me the person I am today. I'm able to be a volunteer. I love volunteering for guide dogs, and as I said before, he gets me out the front door. So I'm able to go up the road to the paper shop on my own. I don't have to have somebody else. I can go to the shops, I can go to the hairdressers. Leo has put a smile back on my face. I think I'm a happier person, and I don't just sit at home watching the television or whatever. I've actually got something to do and aim for. Leo and guide dogs have made a huge difference. Before Leo came into my life, I didn't go out very much at all on my own. I'd stopped going out, so I didn't really have a life. I didn't meet people or have a conversation apart from my husband. But now I'm a member of guide dogs, I'm a volunteer, and Leo gets me in contact with people. I love talking to people when I'm out fundraising, or even just doing things in Tesco's. The normal shop can take 2 hours now instead of the normal hour. I think talking to people about guide dogs is good and helps me as well. Guide dogs is not just about guide dogs. There are various other things that they can do and help people. And that's something I like doing. Being a speaker is one of my ambitions, which I never thought I would do before. But now I have the confidence with Leo by my side to go and do these sort of things.
The Daily Connect podcast.
Now it's time to meet Armila. Now, Armila lost her sight a good few years back. And when she did, she made a decision that she wanted to go on a cruise. Now, that's a decision a lot of us might make in our life, and we think that, you know, well, okay, going on a cruise, what's the big deal? And certainly it wasn't Armila's first cruise either. But when you lose your sight, your world changes. And as a result, going on a cruise meant that that journey would be a lot more than the cruise ship would ever manage to take. She talked to me about that experience and how RNIB helped her make that move.
It wasn't my first time, let's be honest with you. It was my first time after I have lost my vision.
And that was the first time getting out there and yes, going on a big holiday.
Yes.
And where did you go?
We went, well, I wasn't on my own. My husband came with me. I needed somebody to be with me. Otherwise, I would get lost, wouldn't I? We went towards Greece, Malta, Sicily, France, and Cyprus.
On a cruise.
12 days.
Wow.
12 days cruise, yeah. It was amazing.
That sounds amazing. I mean, how does that feel, you know, going on a holiday? I mean, after such a thing like, you know, going through sight loss.
It's the freedom. It's the freedom, the fresh air. It's a feeling which can't be explained. One has to be there to touch the things, to handle different surroundings, to breathe that fresh air, to touch those beautiful flowers that people like myself find it difficult to see, to see those archaeological places, which I always wanted to. I wanted to go to Athens for a very, very long time, but it never materialized. But to be there on that spot, it was amazing. Oh, and wonder, I would say.
Tell me, if you don't mind talking about this, how did you find out you were losing your sight? When did that happen?
A few years ago, I had a detached retina, and the surgery was okay, but that meant after a few years, I developed chronic uveitis, and that means I have been losing my sight gradually. Right now, I can only see the shadows or silhouettes, as I call myself. Night vision is completely lost. but during the daytime. If it's too bright, it hurts. If it's day like today, because it's quite cloudy, I can see silhouettes. I can't see people's faces unless they are just very, very close to me. I can never see people's expressions. I cannot recognize people unless they speak and if I have met them in the past. It's difficult to explain. I use my smell, a sense of smell. I use my sense of touch. Even then, I end up getting too many knocks and end up into silly accidents.
I mean, let's be honest about it. Losing sight is just awful. I mean, it's a horrible experience. Nobody would want to go through that. But it's one of those things that when you are going through it, and you know, you tell me how you feel, but you know, I wonder if it's one of those things that you tend to think that it's not so much the sight you think about losing, it's all the other elements of life all the other things you do or have done in your past that you think you might never be able to do again. Is that the case?
Yes, indeed. It's like as if somebody's thrown you off a cliff top. I was on top of the world, and then a few months later, I found myself right at the bottom. It was very, very hard. Emotionally, I was completely drained. I couldn't say much to my family because they'd get hurt. I had to bear it. But then one day, while I was surfing on the internet, I came across RNIB website. And I said, wonder... they would be able to help me. So very secretly, I rang them. I didn't tell anybody in my family. Then I was in London because my son said, come, stay with us, Mom. We'll look after you. And there I rang RNIB, and somebody at the other end answered my phone call. It was like... as if an angel had answered my question. I spoke with that person and I was offered counseling. I still didn't tell my family. Every Thursday I would just hide upstairs, shedding my tears, talking to this person. And he really brought me out, gave me so much confidence. So I am forever obliged to the organization, and particularly that person. He didn't judge. He just listened and advised me whatever he thought was best. That really helped me. When I came to Leicester, that's in the Midlands, of course, Vista, we have a very good organization called Vista. A very good counselor helped me here as well. It's like... You lost completely in this madness, and don't know where to turn to. And the community I belong to, blindness is a taboo. People don't want to talk about it. People don't want to accept it. And when I go out with my long cane, people think, they still think that there must be something wrong with my legs. But then they turn around and they whisper, they say, oh, but she can walk properly, look. That hurts. That really hurts.
It seems to me that there are so many barriers that we have to go through as visually impaired people. And as you say, the community that you live in adds more barriers to that and the community you're part of. I guess that is obviously one of the biggest challenges for you, I guess, because, you know, being accepted is something we all want.
Yes. That word acceptance is like a miracle word. That's the reason why sometimes when I do go out, I feel I have a lump in my throat. What would today be like? Will there be people staring? They do stare anyway. That's not the point. But when they when they pass a comment, a negative comment, it is very painful. And that is not just one community. It happens everywhere we go. It's like people need to be educated.
You know, when we started off this conversation, you know, we're talking about you going on holiday and going on a cruise. And for most people, that's a decision that they make on a Friday night at home, you know, in a wet January, you know, when they're thinking of how awful life is at the moment because it's so miserable outside and all of that. Yes. You made that decision, and it wasn't just I'm going on a holiday. This was life-changing for you.
Definitely life-changing. It took me, let's say, several weeks to do the research, thinking, where could we go? Where shall I go? What do we need to do? Which is the best place to go? And then suddenly I remembered. I said, I always wanted to go on a cruise because that's something I love to see. My husband loves the sea because we were both brought up by the seaside. And then we said, okay, let's find a nice cruise. So here I was searching and surfing and finally found one that suited us and suited our budget as well.
When people are losing their vision, certainly people I've talked to, and I, you know, I'm in probably a slightly different scenario because I've always had a visual impairment since day one. So it's a different experience for me. You know, I've always been this way and I've had my sight deteriorate over time, but it's not been at that level of going from full sight to either very little or no sight, or as you, in your case, shapes, shadows, that kind of thing.
Yes.
So it's a very different experience. So that's why I'm intrigued by this, because I think that what I tend to hear is that people who lose their vision often start to appreciate things in life that, you know, the everyday things that fully sighted people take completely for granted, like reading a book or going out for a nice walk or, in your case, going on a lovely holiday. Those things mean so much more because you felt perhaps at one time that you might never have been able to do them again. So, you know, actually, in a way, you've realised that those options are open to you and you appreciate them for that reason. Is that fair?
Yes. Yes, indeed, you're right. You see, for a, I would say, normal person, an average person, they don't need to think. They don't need to organize. They would just pack their bags and go. But for people like myself, we need to think. We need to organize more in the sense that what goes in the suitcase to how am I going to board the plane. So, yes, we have to put in lots of thoughts into it. But at the end of the day, after all that, I wouldn't say stress, or after all that hard work, when you find yourself onto that ship, you feel, wow, I did it. The ship has not even sailed. But to be on that, you feel, yes, it's an achievement. It is an achievement, let's put it that way.
Thank you for giving me your time and your thoughts and being so honest as well. It's been really interesting talking to you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Finally on the podcast today, just a quick note on a book that we told you about earlier on the show. It's called The Guilty Feminist. If you're looking for something new to listen to, this might be a good option for you. It's written by Deborah Francis, and she sat down with our own Red Sale, who presents our read-on programme, to tell us all about the book, which was once a podcast.
Deborah Francis White, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, why are you the guilty feminist?
Well, The Guilty Feminist started as a podcast, and some of your listeners may know it. It's a podcast about our noble goals as 21st century feminists, but our hypocrisies and insecurities which undermine those goals. So it's like exfoliating our guilt away and laughing about it and saying it doesn't really matter. Or if it does matter, it is serious. Like, let's look at it, put it on the table, work on it, build muscle. So we admit things at the top, like true things like, I'm a feminist, but one time I went to a women's rights march and I popped into a department store to use the loo. And when I was in there, I got distracted trying out face cream. And when I came out, the march was gone. So I went, okay, good that I went on the march. Next time I want to make it further. And at first I thought, oh my goodness, I'll get the feminists will kick me out of the club if they hear my confessions. But actually, I discovered that so many other women and men who identify as feminists, and of course non-binary people, said, yes, I also do this. Sometimes I feel a bit claustrophobic at a march and I leave, or sometimes I feel I should be watching this four-hour documentary about the suffragettes, but in fact, I flip over and watch Say Yes to the Dress. Finding those things funny and confessing them means that we can let it go, as opposed to sort of secretly holding on to it and thinking, I don't think I'm a good enough feminist then to speak up at that meeting and say, hey guys, this isn't right, or advocate for people who may not be in the room. And one thing that the podcast is really strong on is not just, you know, saying when white, straight, cis, non-disabled women have as many rights and advantages and as much representation as white, straight, cis, non-disabled men, then we're sorted. That's not the case at all. We really need to be advocating for each other, and it's really important that white women are constantly saying, hold on a minute, there's no women of colour on this panel. Why not? You know, we need to get somebody here. We need to have representation, or for, you know, feminists to be saying that this building that we're having this meeting is inaccessible. How are disabled people going to feel it's possible to come if it's not accessible, or if we haven't thought about that? So the podcast is really, over the time of I've been doing it, which is 2.5 years, I've learned so much from our guests who are women of colour or from the LGBTQ community or are disabled feminists, about how I can be a better feminist and think outside my own experience and understand that there are people who have far fewer advantages than I do, and I need to be advocating and allying for them.
And that actually brings me on to my next question, which was going to be, what do you think disabled groups can learn from feminism? But presumably it's the inclusivity, and maybe actually that blind charities should talk to deaf charities, who should talk to learning difficulty charities.
Sure. I mean, it's the thing with disability, you know, it's not a culture, because every group that seeks to represent people with a certain disability has completely different challenges, you know, from other groups. But you're right, you know, working together. I think essentially feminism is a demand for inclusion. You know, feminists need to be advocating for disabled women. And also, you know, non-disabled women need to understand that they have privileges that disabled men don't have. So, you know, we very much subscribe to intersectional feminism, which means that your gender, you know, where you can be pushed into the margins because of your gender. If you watch or listen to television, you will see that there are many, many more men represented in positions of power and influence than women. But our gender intersects with disability. It intersects with race. It intersects with sexual orientation and gender identity.
So can a man be a feminist?
Oh, for sure. Feminism is just a demand for inclusion and a recognition that there is a power imbalance and a representation imbalance between men and women. If you're advocating for that gender balance to be closed, whether you're a man or a woman or you're non-binary, you are absolutely a feminist.
And have toxic men like Donald Trump and Harvey Weinstein, in a perverse way, helped the feminist movement by focusing attention on just how negative men's attitudes can be towards women?
I think it's centering them to say that it's helped feminism. I don't think you can ever say Harvey Weinstein and Donald Trump have helped feminism. That's like they're the reason we need feminism. Mm. So, you know, feminism is a demand for change. It would be better if we didn't need to have such an extreme change. So no, I don't think you can say that they've helped feminism when they're the reason we need it. But certainly I do think that the election of Donald Trump alerted the world to the fact that it was like a jolt, it was a wake-up call, that things have been sliding further to the right for a long time. And it was sort of like punctuated equilibrium. We just suddenly went, oh my goodness, if someone like Donald Trump, who said such misogynistic things about women over the years, and the so-called locker room talk, which was so extreme, that he was recorded on that bus, and still women voted for him as well as men, admittedly largely white women, then yes, we need feminism. So I would say it did alert us to how much more urgent feminism was. And I think it's activated a lot of feminists.
Now, as far as writing the book is concerned, did you find yourself putting in different material or going more deeply into the material you had than you did with the podcast?
Totally, yeah. I was able to do a much more deep dive and really think about what I thought about feminism and construct an argument. And, you know, normally you've got a guest on, you've got a co-host, you've got a theme of the week. You know, there's a lot to juggle. And so it was great to be able to sit down with my own thoughts and do some research and rethink what I thought about feminism and why the idea of guilty feminism, which is basically the idea that we don't have to be perfect to be a force for meaningful change. It's all right to admit, like, this week, like, I did this and this, this, but also I did this, this, and this, and to build muscle and to try and make yourself a stronger feminist is worthwhile. So I was able to form an argument, and really, I think the conclusion I came to when I was writing the book was feminism is not just a movement that stands against something. It's a movement that stands for something. And with this new wave of feminism, we've taken control of the means of production. Because of the internet, we're able to publish podcasts and blogs and videos, and we're able to make stuff. And what's exciting about that is, instead of just pointing at something and saying, we don't want that, we can start to create the world we do want to live in. We can become architects, not just critics. That's what's really exciting.
And I think that's something that disabled groups would like to be following in your footsteps very quickly, as far as that's concerned.
Oh, completely. Start to create the space you want to live in and try and start to be part of the new fabric. Like, we don't just have to bring a hammer to knock something down. Yeah. We have to bring bricks to build something new.
Exactly.
And that's what the Guilty Feminist is. It's a microclimate where women do well, and women from all of these other marginalized groups that we've referenced can be celebrated, and the assumption is when they come on the show they're going to be amazing, and the audience, live audience, cheer them, and you see the women on the podcast soar in a way that they can't if they're like one woman on a panel of six, or where everyone else is a man, or one person of color, one person with a disability explaining what it's like to be disabled. You know, rather having a mainstream space where a bunch of different disabled people can, or a variety of blind people could say, hey, we all have these different experiences, or, oh yeah, that's a common shared experience. And they can make something fun and funny and compelling and entertaining and relatable. I mean, that's the most wonderful thing to do, rather than just sort of going into those mainstream spaces which have been designed for and by white, straight, posh men who are not disabled, and trying to sort of just sit on the end and just speak for your group. Rather, your group creates a space that other people wish to inhabit. That's the most exciting thing.
Exactly. Be proactive rather than reactive.
Exactly, yeah. It's exciting.
Now, you have helped make your book as accessible as possible by narrating it as well, haven't you?
I have. I've done an audiobook, and because I'm a podcaster and I'm a comedian, I really enjoyed performing it, and I feel like there's a sort of added element. So I feel like listening to the book, in some ways, the listeners will get more dimension. So I really hope that the audiobook is popular with everyone. So I think, you know, for your listeners, they may be getting more with the audiobook than some of the readers are getting with the print book, because, you know, my intention can be there in the way that I tell the joke. We recorded little bits and pieces of it in front of a live audience. The last chapter in front of a live audience, you're getting the audience laughing. So yeah, I think it was a really fun thing to do. And people kept saying, isn't it hard to read out a book, because it takes days to do it and it's quite tiring? And I was like, it's a lot easier reading a book than it is writing a book, let me tell you. So writing it is the hard part. Reading it out, that's the fun part.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to listening to it, as I'm sure are my wife and two daughters. So they can hold me up for comparison as to whether my feminist credentials measure up.
Amazing. Okay, we look forward to it.
Deborah Frances-White, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you. it's been an unqualified delight. The Guilty Feminist is available now in audiobook. I hope you enjoy it, and please tweet me at Deborah FW and tell me what you thought.
Make sure I will do. Thank you so much.
I'm Deborah Francis White from The Guilty Feminist, and I would like to wish the RNIB a very happy 150th anniversary.
Thank you, Deborah. And that's it for the podcast today. We're back tomorrow on air 10 till 12. Join me if you can live on Freeview Channel 7:30, or you can find us online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk. We're also available on your smart speaker as well. All you have to say is play RNIB Connect Radio. But if you can't do any of that, we're back on the podcast tomorrow from 5. See you then.
The Daily Connect Podcast.